Jesse Frost is a farmer, gardener, author, and podcast host. He is the creator of the No-Till Growers Network. His book is The Living Soil Handbook. He is the host of the No-Till Market Garden podcast, and he resides in Kentucky. Welcome to the program, Jesse.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me.
Well, let's jump right into it. What is the No-Till Grow Network?
Yeah, so the No-Till Growers Network is kind of an extension of notillgrowers.com, which is a website we started several years ago to be a sort of hub for collecting information that farmers needed about how to grow more ecologically, more sustainably, and without tillage. So the network is our podcast side that, you know, is where we put all of our podcasts, all of our very niche podcasts, I should say. So such as the Composter podcast, the Winter Growers podcast, and et cetera. So, it's kind of just, we dig into the nitty gritty details on everything and, try to explore ideas that maybe, aren't always out there because they're so niche.
Okay, fantastic. So tilling is common in so many ways of growing. Why no-till? And, why no-till?
Yeah, so you're right. Tilling is in many ways, you know, it's in many forms of agriculture. I learned to grow with tillage myself. We have to just kind of look at what tillage does to the soil. So when you run a tiller through a garden bed or through a farm, what you're doing is you're whipping in a lot of oxygen into the soil, and you are breaking up a lot of soil aggregates, so little collections of soil organic matter. And when you whip in all that oxygen, a lot of, oxygen-loving bacteria get really excited about that, and they start consuming a lot of your soil organic matter. Soil organic matter is really important. It holds moisture when it's dry. It releases moisture when it's too wet. It acts as food for microorganisms that then in turn feeds the plants. So when you release, you know, when you kind of enliven these oxygen-loving bacteria, they consume all that soil organic matter and release it as CO2 into the atmosphere. So without plants above them to recollect that CO2 and put it back into the soil, like, and through photosynthesis, without that happening, you lose all of that to the atmosphere, and effectively your soil gets depleted. Now, it also becomes more susceptible to wind and rain and sun exposure and all the erosion that can occur there. And it also, you know, tillage break kills your earthworms and a lot of your arthropods and those sorts of things that you need. It also brings up a bunch of weed seed. So although there is an ecological side to not tilling, there's also just a practical side. I know that when I was learning to farm, I spent a lot of time cultivating, and that's not exactly the most fun thing to do, and I would work until dark doing it. And now, 5, 6, 7 years into not tilling at all on our farm, we don't ever do that. I don't work past 3 or 4 p.m., and it's wonderful. So there is also that side. And the food is good. You know, the food responds better to the soil. We hold our moisture better, and that's the sort of practices that we want other people to employ, because we don't want farming to be something that, you know, takes all of your time and your energy and hurts your back and all of these things. We want it to be something fun, something that basically anybody can do. So that's why we focus so much on this idea of not tilling.
Now, I'll tell the story. Back years ago, when I grew up on a large, big ag farm in southern Illinois, the extension agencies and all those people that were upper, they'd tell the farmers, here's what's best to do. They would inform the farmers, you can no-till, but only for 7 years, and then you've got to till the soil in order to because there's going to be so much compaction, nothing's going to grow. Obviously, this is a different type of mindset nowadays.
Right. And it's also a different approach, because there are, you know, a lot of the bigger style of no-till involves chemical usage.
Right.
And you end up with this sort of what they call like a stratification. If you can imagine just like layers of plant matter, and it does actually get compacted because you're also using a lot of tractors. So if you're not growing plants year round, which is another big part of what we do, like cover cropping, then yeah, it can end up in a negative situation if you're, you know, using chemicals to terminate crops and you're not tilling it. But it's
and you've got dead soil. You don't have any life in the soil when you're going that route as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that life is everything to your plants. You know, that life releases all the nutrients for your plants to consume and grow from.
Absolutely. Now, tell us more about your book, The Living Soil Handbook. If somebody were to pick up a copy, what could they expect or what would pique their interest? Or just tell us more about it.
Yeah, one of the things about this style of growing is that there's so many different ways to do it. So what I wanted to do was not create exactly a choose your own adventure, although I loved those as a child. I wanted to create something that would give you not just like, this is how I do things on my farm, but this is how plants work. This is how soil works. And here's some many different ways that you can, employ that. You know, employ things like photosynthesis and, mulches and all of the things that come along with no-till growing, depending on what your context is, what you have available to you. So the idea being, I just wanted people to be able to pick up the book and go, oh, I can use these things and maybe these other things I can't use, but all of this will lead to healthier soil, healthier plants, and, you know, just a more easier work environment.
Knowledge. That's what your book is, knowledge. What can we do that's as effective or more effective, but is easier on the farmer or grower themselves?
Yeah. So is that the question?
That was just a point that, you know, that we want to have the same or better impact and let nature work with us, then fight against it and then try to make it easier on us as the gardener, as the farmer.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a really good example of that is something like weeds. We think of weeds as these things that are, you know, trouble in the garden, but really they're nature telling us that it needs photosynthesis, right? It's like emergency solar panels popping up and saying, like, we need photosynthesis. And if you're not going to do it for us, we'll do it ourselves. So those little signs, the things that we're always fighting, are actually nature just giving us hints as to what we should be doing, keeping it covered and keeping it planted as much as possible.
Now, you're the host of the podcast of the No-Till Growers Network. And what has been one of the most beneficial things that you have learned when interviewing people for your podcast?
Yeah, and I should say that I've stepped back a little bit from hosting. So we have four new hosts, or three new hosts, technically. And I still assist with that, but I did it for five seasons. And I learned a ton. One of the biggest things that I learned was just how critical it is to appreciate context, that a farm in Kentucky, where I am, is very different from a farm out in California, and both of those farms are very different from farms up in Canada versus farms down in Sandy, Florida. So context is very critical and in many different ways. And I was really blown away with how many different ways there are to do this style of farming based on your context, what materials you have available. Maybe you don't have, abundant, straw there, but maybe you have abundant compost, or maybe you don't have compost or straw or hay that you can trust and you have to use cover crops. There's so many different ways to do it. And I think that was one of the exciting things for me, is to learn just how many different ways people are doing it and people can do it.
Well, when you say about sources you can't trust, you're referring to they've got chemical based on them and you just don't know the source, or what do you refer to that being?
Sure. Yeah, that's an important clarification, because there are not all compost is created equal. We are finding a lot of persistent herbicides. There's been an enormous PFAS forever chemical issue up in Maine and elsewhere. There are, with hay, you end up, some growers will spray broadleaf herbicides on their hay, and those broadleaf herbicides, obviously we grow a lot of broadleaf plants in a garden. So we don't necessarily want that hay up against our plants. Same thing with for straw. So there are all these little nuances to these materials that, maybe weren't as big of an issue or weren't as obvious of an issue, but now that we're using them in bulk, hay and straw and compost and those sorts of things, wood chips, we do have to take a little bit more consideration into how it was produced and if it was treated at all before we put it around our plants.
And with these chemicals, they are grown, the plants are sprayed, the animals consume it, kick it out the back end, turn it into compost, and it's still active. It's that strong.
Yeah, and there's many reasons for that. Sometimes, yes, they aren't. They're, you know, a lot of these chemicals are built to not be broken down by water, and so you know, so they're not water soluble. So they end up just staying there for a very long time. They're intentionally difficult to break down. And same with the PFAS chemicals. Like, their whole thing is that they're in a lot of waterproofing and fireproofing. So their whole thing is resistance to decomposition. So even in really good compost scenarios, you can end up with some of these chemicals getting through. And we have friends who've lost many crops to that, you know, to persistent herbicides inside of their compost, which is also really hard to test for and very unfortunate. But composters are doing, I should say, like, just if you're worried about that, talk to the composter and see what they do to mitigate that issue. That's the biggest tip I can give you, because the good ones will tell you they right. take it very seriously.
Right. And the ones that they don't want to tell you, don't buy from them.
Yeah, or maybe they don't know. If don't know, that's another red flag, because they may not even be aware of it.
True.
Okay, so if people want to switch to no-till, is it pretty easy and straightforward? Are there any tips or tricks, things for them to keep in mind before they take that plunge?
Yeah, I would do some research and start small. Like, if you have a system that works relatively well for you, like if you till your garden and you've got your weeds situation figured out, stick with that for now, and then just start some different no-till trials and see what works in your system and look around. I go through a lot of that in the handbook too, just, you know, the different ways to transition to no-till. But I think the biggest thing is start small. Just try a couple different things, maybe try a bed or two, try a couple crops, and just see if you like the production, see if it worked for you. Take all the different things into consideration. Because one of the biggest mistakes you could make is going full tilt and then not having a successful year because maybe the compost wasn't very good that you used, or, you used a really cold mulch in a really cold place. So, like, lighter colored mulches, oftentimes people put them down in really cold places, and that just really cools your soil. So you know, summer loving, heat loving crops don't do as well. So those, you know, those little nuances are important. So I think starting small is the biggest tip.
Well, with all of your experience in growing no-till, have you had something now you look back on going, I can't believe I did that. That was a total mistake. I should have knew better.
Oh, that's every day for me.
Okay.
No, I do so many different things on our farm because we run no-till growers. I try experiment all the time. And the biggest thing is, as long as you're meeting the basic needs of the plant, it needs water, it needs sunlight. As long as you're getting those things done, most crops will succeed. You know, but you do want to address compaction. That's a big one, is assuming that, you know, putting compost over really compacted soil, that the crops will do well because there's so much compost. That's not necessarily the case. Sometimes you do have to maybe lightly broad fork just to open up the soil a little bit. There's little nuances to it that I think are, that, you know, have taken me a little while to accept and to learn. That's the biggest thing, I think.
And broad forking, for those who are not familiar, that's not a tillage. That is just simply allowing cavities to be placed in the soil for water and air to get down in order to loosen a little bit of the compaction.
Right, correct. It's like you can imagine like a large digging fork, and you just lightly pull it back, and you just kind of pop the soil just a little bit, just enough to get some oxygen, some air down there. And then also some of that compost that maybe you have on the surface can kind of fall into those cracks and fill it in a little bit. And that'll act as plant food and help, you know, break up that compaction. Because compaction is one of the hardest things on plants. You can imagine, you know, a plant root trying to break through concrete. It's going to take a while. So you want to sort of, at least in the first couple of years, sort of address that. And then you won't have to after a while. And you know, it can be a little bit of a gradual uptake with no-till. Like I said, every context is everything. And if your context is really compacted soil, you may have to address that.
And in a backyard garden, you can have distinct grow areas and permanent walk paths, so you're not dealing with the level of compaction that you would have when you did quote-unquote traditional gardening.
Sure. Yeah. And that way also you can control where your paths are and where your beds are. We do that on our farm, even though we grow on roughly an acre. our beds stay in the same place year after year, and our pathways stay in the same place year after year. And I talk about those things in the book too, just to, especially just pathway management is underappreciated. It's a very important part of this whole thing because you have your, you know, bare pathways, you have wood chips. We use a lot of living pathways. So there are a lot, there are living plants in the pathway. So those things are, you know, all have to be taken into consideration, but yeah, that not stepping, not, you know, keeping your beds in the same place means that they're not getting stepped on, not getting walked on, not being compacted.
Fantastic. Well, we've really enjoyed having you on the program today. How can people find out more about you and your great information and your book and all of that?
Yeah, you can find more information at notillgrowers.com. And I always recommend people start with the YouTube channel. We, you know, do a lot of informational videos there that are very specific, but also kind of some of the broader stuff that gets you into no-till and kind of understanding how it works. And that's, you know, just can look up No-Till Growers on YouTube. That's a great way to find us.
Well, Jesse, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered and the knowledge you've shared with Holly, myself, and all of our listeners. We thank you for that.
Well, and thank you all so much for having me on.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.